Ja, mich baut der Riss den Ampenzeller. Presst der Kass mit Samt am Teller.
This is Susie Lyon here for Swiss Parts. Thank you so much for joining me for this episode. I've got a really great episode coming up for you. I've got an interview with Carrie Rick. He's the co-director of Les Arts Scéniques, which is a drama school in Basel. He's had a really interesting and full career. He's met some really interesting people and he has a great story to tell. So actually, I didn't do this interview. That's right. I passed the reins over to somebody else. So I asked my friend Gary to join me to be a guest co-host. I hope that you enjoy Carrie's interview, but also Gary as a host. Gary and I will be working together over the next coming weeks as restrictions kind of loosen on the coronavirus situation. So we're hoping to get some local people to Basel into my home studio to make some recordings for Swiss Pats, and Gary's going to help me out with that. So let me know what you think. Let me know if I should give Gary a job or not. I'm looking forward to your feedback and I hope that you enjoy Carrie's interview regardless. So as I said, the corona restrictions are loosening and that is happening around June 8th. So we're at the end of May at the moment and in the next couple of weeks, things are going to start easing. And I think that's interesting that things are going to start opening up. We're going to start seeing a lot more things being able to be done again. Things like the railway stations in the mountains, boat tours, the outdoor swimming pools will be opened, as well as the wellness facilities like spas, that sort of thing. The zoos, the parks that haven't been closed down, the cinemas, the theatres, the concerts, which is an exciting one, as well as the casinos for all those blackjack players who have been missing out. Now, I'm not sure what you think about this. I am definitely in two minds. I have been into my local town in Basel maybe two times and regretted it both times. It seems like there's a lot of people that forgot that there's a pandemic happening right now. Nothing has been eradicated. We've still got a pandemic to deal with. So it's very, very interesting how people have kind of forgotten. I don't know about you, but I've been seeing a lot of posts about things that say there'll never be a normal like before. Our new normal will be, this new way of living, this new way of working. And after spending a week seeing people just go back to normal, I just don't believe that's going to happen. People have already forgotten about the restrictions and what they're there for. So what makes us think that anything will be any different when things are fully lifted? I just don't see us having any new way of living. I think that we will all go back to normal. Maybe some of us will be a little bit more cautious, but I think in the end, we'll all just live the way we did 10 weeks ago, which was just our normal lives. But I mean, what do you think? Do you completely disagree with me? Do you think there is going to be a new normal, something that doesn't look like the way it was 10 weeks ago? I'm not sure. I'm convinced. I don't know. Let me know what you think. Now, quite a few of you have reached out to me and let me know that my website is down. Thank you so much. It does not only mean so much to me that you reached out to let me know, but it also means so much that there's people still heading to the website to download episodes. I am fully aware that it is down. I have a new website coming. I hope that you will be patient with me. I'm doing it all on my own because Swiss Pats is a passion project. So this is something that I am doing without the help of somebody else. So the website is coming, but I'm not a website designer. So it will be taking a little bit more time. And I hope that those that have reached out will continue to check it out. And I will, of course, let you know when it is back up. But thank you so much to those multiple people who reached out and said, hey, just so you know, your website's not working. But if you are interested, if you're listening to this, then you already know somewhere to download it. But if you've got family or friends that you think would be interested in hearing about the Swiss Pats podcast, this is where you can download it. You can see all of our posts on Facebook and Instagram. On those posts will be the links to where you can download it. The very first one is Anchor. Anchor is a website where you will be able to see all of the latest episodes and you can click on it and listen to it there directly. If you have an app on your phone that is either iTunes or Google Podcasts or Spotify, you can listen there. If you can think of a podcast place, then we are probably on it. So thank you so much once again for listening. Firstly, I hope you really enjoy Carrie's interview. He's a great guy, really, really great. If you have got children or you're an adult that's interested in drama, definitely head to Lea Sanique. They are a great, great drama company that I have really enjoyed working with through my daughters, and I highly recommend them if you're interested in that field. As well as, obviously, as I say, Gary, I want to give him lots and lots of positive feedback from you listeners, so let me know what you think. I want to hear from his family and his friends that are no doubt listening to his first foray into the Swiss Pass podcast, so let me know. Thanks, guys, and enjoy the interview.
Good morning, this is Gary Colin filling in for Susie on Swiss Pats podcast. Thank you for joining us. Joining me, Carrie Rick, who is the co-director of, and excuse me, my French is horrible, but Les Arts Cyniques.
Good.
That's right.
You got it. Yeah.
in Basel, Carrie has a storied career in theater and dance, and we are going to talk about what led him to Switzerland and what led him apparently all over the world. So welcome, Carrie.
Thank you very much for the invitation. Hello.
Yes. So you have been teaching one of Susie's daughters. Is that correct?
Nora, yes. One of our stars. She's an extremely not only talented but a very very witty child. I've seldom met a child that young, or as young as she was at the beginning, in any case, that had such a fine sense of humor. She's terrific.
Were you younger than Nora when you started in acting or dancing first? Which was your first?
Well, dancing was forbidden me by my father. Boys didn't do that. That's what I wanted to do always. I was a fan of dancing from Hollywood movies in the late 40s. I was all inspired when I saw these groups of people in color and moving around. So I always wanted to be a dancer. So he forbid that. So I became an actor, and I started acting at 12. On local television for 2 years in children's series, WBKB Chicago local television. One was called the Poco Loco Show and the other one was called the Magic Toy Shop. And it was a very good first experience working in a studio with rehearsals at the same day, at the same time every week, the lights, the director telling us exactly what to do, and then there was a click and it was live. Wow. So this was, I think, very good training at the time. For me to understand something about the discipline of performing.
This was during the golden age of television, is that?
I think so, yes. Yes, yes.
1950s, I Love Lucy age.
That's right. That's right, yes.
So when did you take up dance? Was that not until much later?
Well, I was a professional actor then, as a teenager, so to speak, and also did, of course, school theater and community theater. And then when moved out when I was 18 to live by myself, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And then I started to dance. Wait, it was 19. I started to dance earlier when I was 21. Mm-hmm. I left for Europe and because I wanted to go to a particular school in Berlin, the Mary Wigmann Studio. She had been a very famous expressive dancer in the 1930s and had a legendary reputation. And I wanted to do that. I was too old at that age to start dancing. Nonetheless, I was completely obsessive. I wanted to learn how to do it. And that was the first training. And I made I toured all of Europe then afterwards in my one-man show for 20 years. And I was 28 when I started that, so to speak, or not 20, I was 25. But in any case, then I toured all of Europe and did what I had always wanted to do, and that was to communicate with my fellow men through movement. I was so glad after the first performance, and when I read the first review, it was a big success. I thought, thank God, now I don't have to speak anymore on stage. I was really obsessed with finding out how is it possible to communicate with people without words? The communication was the most important thing to me, that the audience understood what I was trying to say. that had something to do with my childhood, where I always felt misunderstood, like an idiot, like no one knew what I wanted, or I didn't know how to say it, or no one was interested. So I think that that was a very important motivation. It was unconscious, of course, but a very important motivation to me to prove to myself that I can express myself clearly and that the other people understand what I mean. And that was actually my motivation in art and theater art.
And I would imagine you were invited by Marcel Marceau to perform with him. Did you know mime before that, or was that your first foray into that art?
I didn't, and well, I had seen him on stage. I didn't know mime in that sense. But of course, as an actor, you work also in mime, so to speak, yeah, with imagined actions that you were doing and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. And I was invited by him to come to Paris and show him my work. He was interested to know, what is that? What is this guy doing? And then he offered me a job. He was going to perform at the Théâtre des Champs-Élysées he had a long run, 50 performances, and he needed two people to work with him on stage for three numbers. So it was a big decision for me. It meant leaving Berlin, where I was at home, or I felt at home. And I thought, well, okay, why not? He himself was not very appealing to me as a person, and certainly was horrible working with him. He was a real diva. Which is, by the way, extremely unprofessional. Really, great performers are not divas. They're just workers, you know.
Have you come across more divas or more professionals?
Well, to be honest with you, I came across that. Well, it was a very big shock, because I had a very idealistic notion of theater and theater art, and I was shocked by the amount of divas that I met. They were not necessarily stars or celebrities. They could be people who are working as stand-ins, but they have this particular character, and I found it very estranging. I thought, why are these people putting on? Or I couldn't understand. I was too primitive in a way. But then every now and then one meets a celebrity, even a famous person, who is absolutely normal and down to earth and just a colleague, not at all a diva. Yeah, and that's very refreshing. Uh-huh. And I feel okay, now I'm in reality again.
Yeah. Well, you worked for a little bit with silent film legend, Marlene Dietrich.
Yes, and she was the most normal person I ever met in my whole life. A wonderful person. And really, she became a great friend. I miss her a great deal, especially nowadays. She was extremely down to earth. She walked around with a book under her arm. She wasn't at all, she only got made up and dressed up and so on and so forth on stage. And I met her at a very tragic time of her life, I think, because she was actually a prisoner in her own apartment in Paris as an older woman and had to work to earn money, to pay for her rent, to pay for this, to pay for that. And her only way of working at that time, the way she wanted to work, I presume, was to perform concerts, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And they were very tiring for her, because it meant a rigmarole of getting into a wig, getting into a particular corset, getting into that particular dress. The lighting had to be just so, in order for her to create an illusion of being this glamorous movie star, which she did, I must say, beautifully. It was exquisite. And it was what was exquisite about it is that she was entirely conscious of what she was doing. It was like she was saying to the audience, you want to see it? Now I'll offer it to you. This is what you want to see, isn't it? And completely aware that she is herself, but this is what the audience wanted to see. And that gave a very special edge to this performance. And she was very good. She was obviously a very experienced performer who had been very well trained as a youngster in theater. And she wasn't at all, because she was such a celebrity, of course, I asked no personal questions. That can be very annoying for celebrities to try and delve into their private life. That's something you know in the theater. You just don't do it. Especially
everybody's asking them the same questions.
The same question. They want to stick their nose in their private life and so on and so forth. And I was just, what's the word? We had been, actually we met under very strange circumstances. I had been invited by the fashion designer, Pierre Cardin, who was a fan, to be a guest on two performances she was doing at his theater in Paris. For UNICEF, the United Nations Children's Fund, mm-hmm. and hadn't met her, but I arrived I arrived, got prepared to start. I started the performance. And Cardin made the very big mistake, and it was, he was really naive in that sense, by offering this audience, who was paying a fortune for this charity benefit, these two benefits, he offered them champagne as they walked in the door. Yeah. So the audience, by the time I started, it was an hour late, which was really scary, and the audience was drunk, but completely drunk. Dietrich, with whom I shook hands, she arrived in pants and a shirt and a cap, and she said, it's good that we can greet each other now because I'm going to be very nervous. And I said, you, me too, and so on and so forth. And then she disappeared into her dressing room. And she, I remember I was standing in the wings waiting to go on for 1 hour, and she kept coming out of her dressing room. She said, hey, what's going on? What's happening? What's going on out there? They're so noisy. And I said, I don't know, and so on and so forth. And the curtain opened on me, because they come to see Marlene Dietrich. I thought they're throwing me to the wolves here, or the lions. And the audience didn't shut up. I'd never experienced that in my life. But they also didn't shut up when she came on half an hour later. And she had to really stop the audience. She had to tell them, I'm going to leave the stage. I will come back if you're quiet. No flashbulbs. You can take as many pictures as you want after the performance. She was very, she had a very poor sense of balance at that time. And then the stage lights and the flashlights, she was just thrown over. It was really scary for her. She didn't say that, but I knew very well that that was the reason. In any case, in the middle of my performance, at the beginning of this horror trip, I was trying very hard to change costumes. I changed costumes quickly between six numbers that happened very quickly after each other and appeared always as a completely different type of character. And at a certain point, a zipper wouldn't go up. My assistant was going crazy. She was nervous, this young girl. And all of a sudden, I heard Dietrich say, these people are crazy. And she pushed my assistant away and tried to pull up the zipper at the back of my thing. And I thought, no, lady, you're not going to get this right. This has been rehearsed, all this stuff. And she stood there the whole time, the rest of the time I was on, and was embracing me and telling me I was wonderful, supportively, so to speak, for the rest of this horror trip. And it really became clear to me, this is a colleague, this woman. She was just one colleague coming to the aid of another. Uh-huh. And this so-called star, she really wasn't like that. And that was very impressive. Uh-huh. She impressed me a great deal, completely different than Marceau. He, he was holier than thou, and don't talk to me, and he was, this kind of thing.
Yeah. I have to say, while you were in Paris, that's when you worked on a movie, The Mad Adventures of Rabbi Jacob.
Rabbi Jacob, yes.
Which, during that time, I lived in Israel for a year. My father was on a sabbatical as a teacher in New York, and I saw that movie when I was a child in 1973, 1974, I believe.
That's right.
It came out. That's when we were there. Mm-hmm. So I saw you many, many, many years ago.
Ah, okay. That's not a different version of me, indeed.
Yeah. Yes, I don't remember anything about the movie,
no.
Except that it was a fun movie. Yes. So what parts did you play, and did you do much acting in movies?
No. No, that was it. That was the only film. I was sought out by the director because who had seen me on stage. And I said to him, I'm a performer on stage. I've got contracts, thank God, for the next year. I don't know I'm not going to be a movie star, so I don't know why I should do a movie. This is what I do. I do my one-man show. And he said, how much do you make a night? This director, Gérard Houry was his name. And I said, well, that's a very personal question. He said, do you make $1,000 a night? I said, no. He said, that's what I'm offering you, $1,000 a day. I said, give me the contract.
That was it. 73, that's a lot of money.
That was a lot of money then, yes. It was a so-called third role. In other words, I was a character that had to be in a lot of scenes, but didn't have much to say. I was just it took forever. It took 3 months out of my life, and we were in Paris in these concrete studios, or else then we flew to New York for 2 weeks, where we were doing exteriors or sitting in taxis and so on and so forth. It was under very heavy lights. We were filming in Williamsburg, the Jewish section of where a lot of Jewish people, Orthodox Jewish people live, because they just look great, and he needed that for the background of this thing. So it was a lot. And this guy de Funès, who was the star, was also a diva. So some days he felt like it, or he didn't feel like it. And he said to me, when we saw Russia's in Paris after the first day I filmed, and he was sitting in the seat in front of me, you know, the actors go and see what was filmed the day before, mm-hmm. just to get a chance to see how do I look, how am I doing. And after this first clip came with me, he turned around and he said, you're pretty good, aren't you? I said, well, it wasn't bad, it was okay. He said, yeah, a pity that you're going to be cut out very much. And that's just what he did. He wanted so much to be in the foreground that all my scenes were shortened. It was just, it was amazing, yeah. So I'm in the movie, I'm in the background a lot, but one doesn't see a lot of the stuff that I did. But it was interesting as an experience, but it's very, very strenuous. And I really understood after these months how movie people become crazy. If they have to go through years of this life, getting up at 5:30 in the morning, having people fuss around with the way they look and their hair and their shoes, doing exactly what the director says, look only 30 degrees to the left when you say that, no good, do it again, the lights aren't right, do it again, you could go nuts.
And waiting a couple hours until another scene is set up.
That's right. And I really appreciated the hard work that these people were doing, but it had very little to do with this, for me, with communication of this, with a live audience, which is what I wanted. So that was that. Yes, the movie, I guess, is okay. You should see it again today. I think it's probably on YouTube or someplace.
I wonder if it's on Netflix. It doesn't seem like the type of movie that would be there, but I'm going to have to search it out.
Should, for yourself, reminisce. Go back to the old days, yeah.
Speaking of reminiscing, so you're from Chicago, is that right?
That's right. I grew up in Chicago.
So you were there until you were 18, yet you have a German accent now, which is pretty amazing. Usually when you move someplace, 14 is usually the cutoff. Did you have a Midwest accent back then? Has it just slowly disappeared?
No, I didn't have a Midwest accent because I couldn't when I was acting.
Ah, okay.
That was corrected very, very quickly. Not allowed to do that. And this is the way it has to be said. And so I began listening to myself, how people speak neutrally, so to speak. So I didn't have a Midwest accent. But of course, I've been living in Europe for decades and decades. I lived in America again for 1 year in the 80s, I think. And otherwise, I've been here all the time and I'm extremely old. So I doubt if my English is correct anymore. I was very worried about this interview because I didn't know, am I going to be speaking normally anymore?
Well, I've been here 6.5 years, so maybe I'll start adapting a similar accent.
And it just happens by itself, you know? It's crazy.
Well, I'm from New York, but I never had a New York, even though my mother has a typical New York, accent.
Why don't you?
I don't know. I went into broadcast in college, but I don't think I had much of an accent. I don't know. I was just fortunate, I guess, I think I was only in Brooklyn for my first 3 months, so I didn't have quite enough time to adapt that accent. Yeah. Thankfully, I think. So do you return to the States much now, or is that just a long forgotten?
No, well, everyone's dead. That's how it is. My family is, I have a brother in California who is a doctor, and he works in the Veterans Administration, or he directs a medical thing there, whatever. And we speak frequently on Skype. We see each other every couple of years. Now, at the moment, of course, no one's traveling anywhere. That's quite clear. And no, I haven't been to America in years. And now I have very mixed feelings about it in terms of what's going on there. This insane racist bigot who is the president. And then, of course, his volatile supporters. Mm-hmm. That's a milieu I don't know. I'm just completely shocked at the amount or the quantity of white supremacist dummies, or what should I call them, or fascists that are there. And it's tragic for me because I remember going to grammar school after the war. I mean, not immediately after the war, but at a period when cultural diversity and we're all Americans and people of different colors and different cultures all belong here and get to know each other, and that makes us Americans and so on and so forth. This seems to be all gone now. That America seems to be past.
I mean, I left the States when Obama was still president, and there was still hope in the air. But yeah, in just 6 years, it seems like a different place.
It's crazy. When were you there last?
Last year, I guess. And if I feel like a stranger when I go there now, I feel like just a tourist. It just seems loud. It doesn't.
But you still have family.
Type of place. Yeah, I still have family. They're in Arizona, New York. So I flit about. My wife is from Seattle, so we go to Seattle. We're supposed to be going to Seattle this summer, but that's not going to happen.
Grey's Anatomy.
Yes, so who knows when the next time. Yes, exactly. Who knows when I'm going to get. So getting back to your life's journey, so you started the Institute for Movement Analysis. Is that what it's called?
Yeah, that was very interesting. I was sought out, it was again in Paris, in my dressing room by a woman, a doctor so-and-so, whom I didn't know. And she said she wants to arrange a meeting with me. She just walked into the dressing room after the performance, or knocked, and she said she wants to understand more about the way I understand, my understanding of movement. And I said, okay, fine, but not here and not now. We'll make an appointment. I've got to change and go. And in any case, it became a series of dialogues, meetings with this woman. She was a psychiatrist and the head of psychiatry at a municipal hospital in Paris, clinic. And she was interested to know how I understand human psychology, how I was able to understand human psychology well through movement. What is it exactly that I see that can, that makes it so clear to the audience what this person is inside and so on and so forth, and the way their emotions develop. So I just talked freely with her about what I saw and how I saw, or as much as I know, and so on and so forth. And at the last meeting, she said she just has a new patient at the hospital, a young man who's really not particularly available verbally, hard to reach verbally, and whether I would try to work with him in movement. I said, okay, why not? I myself had had a very intensive psychoanalytic therapy experience when I was 20. So therapy was very familiar to me, what therapy could be or what it means in the sense of depth psychology. I said, okay, sure, why not? And this young man was found in a forest. His family had declared him missing to the police in the south of France. They didn't know where he was and so on and so forth. And then he was picked up in a forest at night because he was playing a saxophone in the middle of the night in the forest and was waking all the neighbors up. And he walked around with the saxophone around his neck. He never took it off and never sat down because he had a whole theory about how sitting kills you. It's a very bad thing. So he would only stand or lean, but never sit. And 6 months later, after working together, he entered the Sorbonne as a university student, completely normal.
Wow.
In normal behavior, outwardly normal behavior. A very extremely intelligent and sympathetic young man who was entirely different from the version I had first met. And that changed my life. That experience. I thought, what am I jumping around on a stage for here only when I have the possibility of being of help to people?
You formed the Institute after?
Yes, well, after that, shortly after that, I had to leave the stage because my spine was a mess, as it often is with dancers, and my hips, because I had, working alone for an hour and a half on the stage in that intensity. For years, it does something to the body, of course. They don't tell you that at the beginning, but most dancers have problems at a certain point. So it has a very high price, or exacts a very high price. So I had to stop, and that's when I, well, it wasn't just then, before I had already moved into this idea. I had met up with dance therapy, and I read a lot of stuff about it, and I thought, my God, this is just some kind of strange worldview here. You know, dancing is going to make you feel better, and dancing certainly didn't make me feel better. And I thought, this is silly. What's the theory behind this? And there wasn't a theory. It was just, you know, a worldview kind of thing, a philosophical kind of thing. And the body, and so on and so forth, all this celebration of the body. And I was not very much interested in the body. I was interested in people and the things they were doing, their movements, but not the body. I mean, it's the same as the person, to my mind. There's no difference between me and my body. That's me, you know. And so I didn't understand the separation, that they were all of a sudden talking about body and mind. I kept saying, what's the same thing? What are you trying to separate? Or are you the dear Lord that can really understand the connection between, you know, our physical self and our psychological self? As far as I understand, it's so complicated that we don't have an overview of that. We have some ideas, but that's it. So I thought, okay, I've got to set this right with this strange idea of dance therapy. I started off as a dance therapist, and I realized at a certain point dancing is not especially a useful medium, especially when you're working with men. They're just not into it that much, yeah, for all kinds of cultural reasons. And I didn't care, because I didn't care about the dancing. What was important to me is that they move, and that I can experience the way they move, or problems they might feel about moving, or the way their movements relate to themselves, blah, 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 all of this kind of thing. So I thought, okay, drop the music and drop the dancing and just ask people to move. And then all of a sudden things worked. So when I worked with children, then I played games. That's what you do in movement with children. You don't ask them, you know, just abstract to move for me. That's crazy. With old people, I had to work with them sitting in chairs. With psychiatric patients, I had to move with them because they needed to orient themselves. And in terms of my expectations, what does this guy want me to do when he says move, or do they even understand me? So I just said, well, let's move together, and stood up and we moved. We're warming up, we're moving our arms, and so on and so forth. And then slowly I developed this theory of movement analysis. Now in the meanwhile, I've trained 500 people in Austria and Germany and here, and even in Portugal, that are working with this method and working successfully in various venues. They're either working in schools with children who have behavioral issues, or they're working with psychiatric patients who are disoriented, or just working with adults. You know, therapy has a very different use today than it did once. It isn't only for sick people. Since there's been a change in the societal change in the structure of the family, we have now, since the Second World War, small family structures, a lot of people have no place to turn to if they want to talk about issues that are important to them, or problems or conflicts that are important to them in everyday life. It can be conflicts concerning relationships, concerning the expectations of others on them that they feel they can't fulfill or don't want to fulfill, or their own wishes which they feel aren't appropriate or adequate to what's expected of them, blah, blah, blah. And so it's good. These are the people that come to therapy because they want to have a place where they can air these things. Someone that tries to understand with them what they want and help them find out ways to get what they want. So it has a very different meaning nowadays. It isn't always associated with mental or emotional illness therapy for this reason.
Do you integrate any of the ideas from that in your theater company, in your in the Les Arts?
I don't know if I should be telling you this or speaking about this openly. Of course, it's affected me a great deal, the experience I've had learning how to understand what people mean. I can't put it another way, yeah? Because very often they're indirect about the way they express it, which is also okay, it's normal, but you have to interpret. And then one has to develop a strategy, especially if one's working with people in theater, of how to get them to do what they want to do. When do I give a criticism? When do I keep my mouth shut? What's the right word that might be a clue for this person to get into their character? Or how does this person get along in the team, in the group? Do they feel overlooked? Do they feel enough that they're enough a part of the group? These are, of course, questions that I now ask spontaneously to myself when I'm working in a group, no matter what the situation is, and it's a help. of course, in making theater. And then, of course, the other aspect is when you're acting or you're directing, you want to create a certain impression to the audience about the characters that are, at the moment, that are involved in the situation. And so a psychological understanding is a help of their inner life, I mean, is a help. What people do on the outside is one thing. What they really mean is very often another. We're just complex human beings in that sense, yeah? So, of course, it's a big help in directing, too.
How do you find it different? So you work with adults and children. So what find the difference between working with the two?
Children have less inhibition when it comes to playing. They're more used to play and to portray things or to try things out. So it's easier than that in that sense to throw out an idea, let them play with it, and then discuss with them how could it be different, how could it be better. We teach them also how to be critical in a good sense. Let's try it again and try it this time in a way that you feel it's more effective. And they do. And they're also able to criticize very well what they do themselves now. Adults are more sensitive. You have to be a little bit more careful not to, first of all, not to invade into their private sphere. That's their privacy. Of course, no one likes that. And it certainly wouldn't be my intention. But, and on the other side, to encourage them to let go their defenses, to let go the control that they need in everyday life, undoubtedly, to play again, to play as if something. So that's it's a slower amount of work. It's no less satisfying. It's just different.
Yeah. So with the kids, so with what you know about the long-term effects on the body with dance, do you encourage kids more to go into acting, or do you teach dance as well, or is it strictly acting?
No, it's strictly acting now. I don't teach dance as well, because I guess there are a lot of people all over the place who teach dance, also to children, who do it very well. They animate. So I concentrate with my wife on our enterprise. It's not a business, but it's an enterprise, and that is to build up this arsenic. And we have a junior ensemble now. Nora is among them, among the children we've worked with for 5 years. And it's extremely moving to us to see how much they've learned in 5 years. Of course, it's moving to watch them grow as well. It's really scary at that age, how quick it is, the changes. But it's really, it's very touching to see how much they've learned, how well they act, and with how much consciousness they act. So we want to keep that up in any case. And we teach in English, by the way. Mm-hmm. We teach them in English.
English and German? Just English?
We have a class in German as well for younger children, 8 to 12. And with adults also in German. And we're going to start a class soon in English for adults, because I guess there's enough of a population here that speaks English. And of course, that interests me very much, of course, as an English-speaking person. Yeah.
I feel like some days I hear more English here in Basel than any other language. That's it's pretty surprising.
Are you involved in the expat community a lot?
My kids go to international school, so most of the people I know from that are expats, which is from all over the world, which is fantastic that my
That's
kids
great.
Do yeah. To ideas and people from everywhere, which yeah, my wife and I find very pleasing.
That was so important to me as an American. And I really missed that at the beginning in Switzerland, because I thought everyone's the same. And I realized how much I like diversity, how much it's normal to me that there are all kinds of shapes and colors and languages and God knows whatever, and cultures. And how excited I was as a child when a playmate would invite me to their home for lunch, you know, at school. Or something, and then the people there were speaking a different language. I was absolutely fascinated, and they were eating a different kind of food. That was fascinating. You know, I was just eyes all over the place, and I associated that with this person, and then watched the way they were behaving with each other, which was maybe a little bit different than we did at home. And that affected me very much. I liked that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's important that kids are exposed to as many different cultures.
Oh, yes.
As much as possible. So let me ask, with your school, so are you looking, do you audition kids for the theater? is there certain talent? Is there certain are there certain things you look for in children when you're bringing?
Well, you can. I think it's very hard to see, to evaluate how talented in quotes a child would be or not would be. It's actually not the point. The point is how motivated are they? How really interested are they in trying this out, in acting? And are they able to work with other children? Mm-hmm. That's an important issue. Not all children are extremely upfront. There are some children who are shy. That's quite okay as well. Or is it a child with a problem who would need a special kind of treatment to working with them? We have to figure that out. And then we also have to see if they can take criticism without feeling insulted. Mm-hmm. Not criticism in a negative sense, but say, can you try and do this differently? And if they can do this, then it's fine. Then please come aboard, come along. And things develop then by right. themselves.
So what challenges do you face now in the time of Corona with Les Arts?
Where do you go from here? Yeah, of course, face the challenges that everyone else does at the moment. It's a very frightening and situation, a very unusual situation. That's it. Someone has to come to grips with it. The quarantine. I'm in a high risk group, of course, at my age, and then so I have to be extremely careful. But the challenge is, of course, we don't want to stop working. So we've tried to move online as much as possible. And in a way, it's very strenuous, but it's exciting because it works, we find out. But of course, we have to learn an awful lot how to do it online and what's different. And even works with the kids, surprisingly enough. For example, we were supposed to do with this junior group we have, we were supposed to do a performance about this time in June with them. We do every year, the kids perform. But of course, that's not possible now because we can't assemble people, or we can't even assemble them to rehearse. So we decided to make a film. Yeah. So we're with them, yeah. So we got a friend who is an expert, she's a filmmaker, to give them lectures on what is it like making a film, what are the things you have to consider, how do you take shots, what kind of different shots are there, and so on and so forth. They were absolutely fascinated, and smart as they are, they took notes and they remembered. And then we asked them to send us clips that they should try out with their phone, to phone themselves. We gave different situations. Let's say it's a Corona situation. You can't go out of the house. You can't meet your friends. Mm-hmm. What's it like? What does this person feel like? Or who's her best friend? And so on and so forth. Or what do you do? What are activities you do outside of the house? Can you take shots of yourself doing something, not talking, but doing something that you do every day that belongs to this character you're playing? They each have evolved a character for this play. And it's absolutely terrific. Of course, now we're sitting there, I have to edit all this stuff, but
it's really, learn, right?
Yeah, but it's fascinating. And again, they've proved how smart they are. Because they're interested in the whole thing. And now I think Nora has decided she wants to do film. Uh-huh. And she says it in a way that's very serious, that I think, whoa, okay, take her seriously. She isn't kidding, this kid. Uh-huh. It somehow interested her, film acting or also shooting, making a film. I mean, she might be a director. It's very possible one day. Yes. So that's, yeah, and with our adults, we're working on monologues from uh-huh. different periods, different epochs, and we're correcting them. How do you play this kind of scene? What's the difference in playing Shakespeare or in playing Tennessee Williams or in playing David Mamet? Or how do I have to act differently? And my approach to role, how is it different? Are the audience's expectations different with a Shakespearean text than they would be with Anton Chekhov? Mm-hmm. You know, and how is it written in such a way that gives me clues about how I have to present it? So this has been very useful as well. And they're all dying to meet again. We are too. And we also have a production that we want to start. The script is ready, but we can't rehearse yet. So it's a little frustrating, but we're doing what we can. We're going to start an online course for grown-ups in English soon. We now have an idea how it can start online in any case, if there are people interested.
Okay.
Should I plug for you the name of our website where they can inform themselves?
Yes, I was about to ask you.
Yeah, yeah. It's called acting-classbasel, one word, .ch. actingclassbasel.ch. And anyone who might want to have consultation with me online, of course, at the moment, it's movement-analysis.ch, movement.analysis.ch. More than welcome. And if you have any issues you want to discuss, come along. I don't care what it is, anything that concerns you in everyday life.
Fantastic.
Yeah, so that's that.
Well, thank you so much for your time, Carrie. I appreciate it. It's been really a pleasure talking to you.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure talking to you. I hope we're able to meet one time, like over a cup of coffee, for example.
That would be awesome. Thank you again, and have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye.